anything. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Howard, how can I try to thank you? Even for...
Don't thank me. If I do it, I'll have my own purpose. I'll expect to gain as much as you will, probably more. Just remember that I don't do things on any other terms.
Keating came to Rourke's house on the following evening. He could not say whether he had waited impatiently or not. The bruise had spread. He could act. He could weigh nothing. He stood in the middle of Rourke's room and looked about slowly. He had been grateful for all the things Rourke had not said to him. But he gave voice to the things himself when he asked, "This is the Enright house, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"You built it?"
Rourke nodded and said, "Sit down, Peter," understanding too well.
Keating had brought his briefcase. He put it down on the floor, propping it against his chair. The briefcase bulged and looked heavy. He handled it cautiously. Then he spread his hands out and forgot the gesture, holding it, asking, "Well?"
"Peter, can you think for a moment that you're alone in the world?"
"I've been thinking that for 3 days."
"No, that's not what I mean. Can you forget what you've been taught to repeat and think? Think hard, with your own brain. There are things I want you to understand. It's my first condition. I'm going to tell you what I want. If you think of it as most people do, you'll say it's nothing. But if you say that, I won't be able to do it. Not unless you understand completely, with your whole mind, how important it is."
"I'll try, Howard. I was honest with you yesterday."
"Yes. If you hadn't been, I would have turned you down yesterday. Now I think you might be able to understand and do your part of it."
"You want to do it?"
"I might. If you offer me enough."
"Howard, anything you ask. Anything. I'd sell my soul."
"That's the sort of thing I want you to understand. To sell your soul is the easiest thing in the world. That's what everybody does every hour of his life. If I asked you to keep your soul, would you understand why that's much harder?"
"Yes. Yes, I think so."
"Well, go on. I want you to give me a reason why I should wish to design Cortland. I want you to make me an offer."
"You can have all the money they pay me. I don't need it. You can have twice the money. I'll double their fee."
"You know better than that, Peter. Is that what you wish to tempt me with?"
"You would save my life."
"Can you think of any reason why I should want to save your life?"
"No."
"Well?"
"It's a great public project, Howard. A humanitarian undertaking. Think of the poor people who live in slums. If you can give them decent comfort within their means, you'll have the satisfaction of performing a noble deed."
"Peter, you were more honest than that yesterday."
His eyes dropped, his voice low. Keating said, "You will love designing it."
"Yes, Peter. Now you're speaking my language."
"What do you want?"
"Now listen to me. I've been working on the problem of low-rent housing for years. I never thought of the poor people in slums. I thought of the potentialities of our modern world. The new materials, the means, the chances to take and use. There are so many products of man's genius around us today. There are such great possibilities to exploit, to build cheaply, simply, intelligently. I've had a lot of time to study. I didn't have much to do after the Stoddard Temple. I didn't expect results. I worked because I can't look at any material without thinking what could be done with it. And the moment I think that, I've got to do it. To find the answer, to break the thing. I've worked on it for years. I loved it. I worked because it was a problem I wanted to solve. You wish to know how to build a unit to rent for $15 a month? I'll show you how to build it for $10.
Keating made an involuntary movement forward.
"But first, I want you to think and tell me what made me give years to this work. Money? Fame? Charity? Altruism?"
Keating shook his head slowly.
"All right. You're beginning to understand. So whatever we do, don't let's talk about the poor people in the slums. They have nothing to do with it, though I wouldn't envy anyone the job of trying to explain that to fools. You see, I'm never concerned with my clients, only with their architectural requirements. I consider these as part of my building's theme and problem, as my building material, just as I consider bricks and steel. Bricks and steel are not my motive, neither are the clients. Both are only the means of my work. Peter, before you can do things for people, you must be the kind of man who can get things done. But to get things done, you must love the doing, not the secondary consequences. The work, not the people. Your own action, not any possible object of your charity. I'll be glad if people who need it find a better manner of living in a house I designed. But that's not the motive of my work, nor my reason, nor my reward. He walked to a window and stood looking out at the lights of the city, trembling in the dark river. You said yesterday, what architect isn't interested in housing? I hate the whole blasted idea of it. I think it's a worthy undertaking, to provide a decent apartment for a man who earns $15 a week. But not at the expense of other men. Not if it raises the taxes, raises all the other rents, and makes the man who earns 40 live in a rat hole. That's what's happening in New York. Nobody can afford a modern apartment except the very rich and the paupers. Have you seen the converted brownstones in which the average self-supporting couple has to live? Have you seen their closet kitchens and their plumbing? They're forced to live like that because they're not incompetent enough. They make $40 a week and wouldn't be allowed into a housing project, but they're the ones who provide the money for the damn project. They pay the taxes, and the taxes raise their own rent, and they have to move from a converted brownstone into an unconverted one, and from that into a railroad flat. I'd have no desire to penalize a man because he's worth only $15 a week, but I'll be damned if I can see why a man worth 40 must be penalized, and penalized in favor of the one who's less competent. Sure, there are a lot of theories on the subject and volumes of discussion, but just look at the results. Still, architects are all for government housing. And have you ever seen an architect who wasn't screaming for planned cities? I'd like to ask him how he can be so sure that the plan adopted will be his own. And if it is, what right has he to impose it on the others? And if it isn't, what happens to his work? I suppose he'll say that he wants neither. He wants a council, a conference, cooperation and collaboration. And the result will be the march of the centuries. Peter, every single one of you on that committee has done better work alone than the eight of you produced collectively. Ask yourself why sometime. I think I know it. But Cortland. Yes, Cortland. Well, I've told you all the things in which I don't believe, so that you'll understand what I want and what right I have to want it. I don't believe in government housing. I don't want to hear anything about its noble purposes. I don't think they're noble, but that too doesn't matter. That's not my first concern. Not who lives in the house, nor who orders it built, only the house itself. If it has to be built, it might as well be built right. You want to build it? In all the years I've worked on this problem, I never hoped to see the results in practical application. I forced myself not to hope. I knew I couldn't expect a chance to show what could be done on a large scale. Your government housing, among other things, has made all buildings so expensive that private owners can't afford such projects, nor any type of low-rent construction. And I will never be given any job by any government. You've understood that much yourself. You said I couldn't get past Toohey. He's not the only one. I've never been given a job by any group, board, council, or committee, public or private, unless some man fought for me, like Kent Lansing. There's a reason for that, but we don't have to discuss it now. I want you to know only that I realize in what manner I need you, so that what we'll do will be a fair exchange. You need me? Peter, I love this work. I want to see it erected. I want to make it real, living, functioning, built. But every living thing is integrated. Do you know what that means? Whole, pure, complete, unbroken. Do you know what constitutes an integrating principle? A thought. The one thought. The single thought that created the thing and every part of it. The thought which no one can change or touch. I want to design Cortland. I want to see it built. I want to see it built exactly as I design it. Howard, I won't say it's nothing. You understand? Yes. I like to receive money for my work, but I can pass that up this time. I like to have people know my work is done by me, but I can pass that up. I like to have tenants made happy by my work, but that doesn't matter too much. The only thing that matters, my goal, my reward, my beginning, my end, is the work itself. My work done my way, Peter. There's nothing in the world that you can offer me except this. Offer me this, and you can have anything I've got to give. My work done my way. A private, personal, selfish, egotistical motivation. That's the only way I function. That's all I am. Yes, Howard. I understand. With my whole mind. Then here's what I'm offering you. I'll design Cortland. You'll put your name on it. You'll keep all the fees. But you'll guarantee that it will be built exactly as I design it. Keating looked at him and held the glance deliberately, quietly, for a moment. All right, Howard, he added. I waited to show you that I know exactly what you're asking and what I'm promising. You know it won't be easy. I know it will be terribly difficult. It will, because it's such a large project. Most particularly because it's a government project. There will be so many people involved, each with authority, each wanting to exercise it in some way or another. You'll have a hard battle. You will have to have the courage of my convictions. I'll try to live up to that, Howard. You won't be able to unless you understand that I'm giving you a trust which is more sacred, and nobler, if you like the word, than any altruistic purpose you could name. Unless you understand that this is not a favor, that I'm not doing it for you nor for the future tenants, but for myself, and that you have no right to it except on these terms. Yes, Howard. You'll have to devise your own way of accomplishing it. You'll have to get yourself an ironclad contract with your bosses and then fight every bureaucrat that comes along every 5 minutes for the next year or more. I will have no guarantee except your word. Wish to give it to me? I give you my word. Rourke took 2 typewritten sheets of paper from his pocket and handed them to him. Sign it. What's that? A contract between us, stating the terms of our agreement, a copy for each of us. It would probably have no legal validity whatever, but I can hold it over your head. I couldn't sue you, but I could make this public. If it's prestige you want, you can't allow this to become known. If your courage fails you at any point, remember that you'll lose everything by giving in. But if you'll keep your word, I give you mine. It's written there. That I'll never betray this to anyone. Cortland will be yours. On the day when it's finished, I'll send this paper back to you and you can burn it if you wish. All right, Howard. Keating signed, handed the pen to him, and Rourke signed. Keating sat looking at him for a moment, then said slowly, as if trying to distinguish the dim form of some thought of his own, everybody would say you're a fool. Everybody would say, I'm getting everything. You'll get everything society can give a man. You'll keep all the money. You'll take any fame or honor anyone might want to grant. You'll accept such gratitude as the tenants might feel. And I'll take what nobody can give a man, except himself. I will have built Cortland. You're getting more than I am, Howard.
Peter!
The voice was triumphant.
You understand that?
Yes. Rourke leaned back against a table and laughed softly. It was the happiest sound Keating had ever heard.
This will work, Peter. It will work. It will be all right. You've done something wonderful. You haven't spoiled everything by thanking me.
Keating nodded silently.
Now relax, Peter. Want a drink? We won't discuss any details tonight. Just sit here and get used to me. Stop being afraid of me. Forget everything you said yesterday. This wipes it off. We're starting from the beginning. We're partners now. You have your share to do. It's a legitimate share. This is my idea of cooperation, by the way. You'll handle people, I'll do the building. We'll each do the job we know best as honestly as we can.
He walked to Keating and extended his hand. Sitting still, not raising his head, Keating took the hand. His fingers tightened on it for a moment. When Rourke brought him a drink, Keating swallowed 3 long gulps and sat looking at the room. His fingers were closed firmly about the glass, his arms steady. But the ice tinkled in the liquid once in a while, without apparent motion. His eyes moved heavily over the room, over Rourke's body. He thought, it's not intentional. Not just to hurt me, he can't help it. He doesn't even know it. But it's in his whole body. That look of a creature glad to be alive. And he realized he had never actually believed that any living thing could be glad of the gift of existence. You're so young, Howard. You're so young. Once I reproached you for being too old and serious. Do you remember when you worked for me at Francone's? Drop it, Peter. We've done so well without remembering. That's because you're kind. Wait, don't frown. Let me talk. I've got to talk about something. I know this is what you didn't want to mention. God, I didn't want you to mention it. I had to steel myself against it that night, against all the things you could throw at me. But you didn't. If it were reversed now and this were my home, can you imagine what I'd do or say? You're not conceited enough. Why, no, I'm too conceited, if you want to call it that. I don't make comparisons. I never think of myself in relation to anyone else. I just refuse to measure myself as part of anything. I'm an utter egotist. Yes, you are. But egotists are not kind. And you are. You're the most egotistical and the kindest man I know. And that doesn't make sense. Maybe the concepts don't make sense. Maybe they don't mean what people have been taught to think they mean. But let's drop that now. If you've got to talk of something, let's talk of what we're going to do. He leaned out to look through the open window. It will stand down there, that dark stretch. That's the site of Cortland. When it's done, I'll be able to see it from my window. Then it will be a part of the city. Peter, have I ever told you how much I love this city? Keating swallowed the rest of the liquid in his glass. I think I'd rather go now, Howard. I'm no good tonight. I'll call you in a few days. We'd better meet here. Don't come to my office. You don't want to be seen there. Somebody might guess. By the way, later, when my sketches are done, you'll have to copy them yourself in your own manner. Some people would recognize my way of drawing. Yes. All right. Keating rose and stood looking uncertainly at his briefcase for a moment, then picked it up. He mumbled some vague words of parting. He took his hat. He walked to the door. Then stopped and looked down at his briefcase. Howard, I brought something I wanted to show you. He walked back into the room and put the briefcase on the table. I haven't shown it to anyone. His fingers fumbled, opening the straps. Not to Mother or Ellsworth Toohey. I just want you to tell me if there's any. He handed to Rourke 6 of his canvases. Rourke looked at them one after another. He took a longer time than he needed. When he could trust himself to lift his eyes, he shook his head in silent answer to the word Keating had not pronounced. It's too late, Peter, he said gently. Keating nodded. Guess I knew that. When Keating had gone, Rourke leaned against the door, closing his eyes. He was sick with pity. He had never felt this before. Not when Henry Cameron collapsed in the office at his feet. Not when he saw Stephen Mallory sobbing on a bed before him. Those moments had been clean. But this was pity. This complete awareness of a man without worth or hope. This sense of finality, of the not to be redeemed. There was shame in this feeling. His own shame that he should have to pronounce such judgment upon a man, that he should know an emotion which contained no shred of respect. This is pity, he thought. And then he lifted his head in wonder. He thought that there must be something terribly wrong with the world in which this monstrous feeling is called a virtue. Chapter 9. They sat on the shore of the lake, Winand slouched on a boulder, Rourke stretched out on the ground, Dominique sitting straight, her body rising stiffly from the pale blue circle of her skirt on the grass. The Winand house stood on the hill above them. The earth spread out in terraced fields, and rose gradually to make the elevation of the hill. The house was a shape of horizontal rectangles, rising toward a slashing vertical projection. A group of diminishing setbacks, each a separate room, its size and form making the successive steps in a series of interlocking floor lines. It was as if from the wide living room on the first level, a hand had moved slowly, shaping the next steps by a sustained touch, then had stopped, had continued in separate movements, each shorter, brusquer, and had ended, torn off, remaining somewhere in the sky. So that it seemed as if the slow rhythm of the rising fields had been picked up, stressed, accelerated, and broken into the staccato chords of the finale.
"I like to look at it from here," said Winand. "I spent all day here yesterday watching the light change on it. When you design a building, Howard, do you know exactly what the sun will do to it at any moment of the day from any angle? Do you control the sun?"
"Sure," said Rourke without raising his head. "Unfortunately, I can't control it here. Move over, Gale, you're in my way. I like the sun on my back."
Winand let himself flop down into the grass. Rourke lay stretched on his stomach, his face buried on his arm, the orange hair on the white shirt sleeve, one hand extended before him, palm pressed to the ground. Dominique looked at the blades of grass between his fingers. The fingers moved once in a while, crushing the grass with lazy, sensuous pleasure. The lake spread behind them, a flat sheet darkening at the edges, as if the distant trees were moving in to enclose it for the evening. The sun cut a glittering band across the water. Dominique looked up at the house and thought that she would like to stand there at a window and look down and see this one white figure stretched on a deserted shore, his hand on the ground, spent, emptied, at the foot of that hill. She had lived in the house for a month. She had never thought she would. Then Rourke had said,
"The house will be ready for you in 10 days, Mrs. Winand."
And she had answered,
"Yes, Mr. Rourke."
She accepted the house. The touch of the stair railings under her hand, the walls that enclosed the air she breathed. She accepted the light switches she pressed in the evening, and the light firm wires he had laid out through the walls, the water that ran when she turned a tap from conduits he had planned, the warmth of an open fire on August evenings, before a fireplace built stone by stone from his drawing. She thought, "Every moment, every need of my existence." She thought, "Why not? It's the same with my body, lungs, blood vessels, nerves, brain. Under the same control." She felt one with the house. She accepted the nights when she lay in Winan's arms and opened her eyes to see the shape of the bedroom Rourke had designed, and she set her teeth against a racking pleasure that was part answer, part mockery of the unsatisfied hunger in her body, and surrendered to it, not knowing what man gave her this, which one of them, or both. Winand watched her as she walked across a room, as she descended the stairs, as she stood at a window. She had heard him saying to her,
"I didn't know a house could be designed for a woman, like a dress. You can't see yourself here as I do. You can't see how completely this house is yours. Every angle, every part of every room is a setting for you. It's scaled to your height, to your body. Even the texture of the walls goes with the texture of your skin in an odd way. It's the Stoddard Temple, but built for a single person. And it's mine. This is what I wanted. The city can't touch you here. I've always felt that the city would take you away from me. It gave me everything I have. I don't know why I feel at times that it will demand payment someday. But here you're safe. And you're mine."
She wanted to cry, "Gale, I belong to him here as I've never belonged to him." Rourke was the only guest Winand allowed in their new home. She accepted Rourke's visits to them on weekends. That was the hardest to accept. She knew he did not come to torture her, but simply because Winand asked him, and he liked being with Winand.
She remembered saying to him in the evening, her hand on the stair railing, on the steps of the stairs leading up to her bedroom, "Come down to breakfast whenever you wish, Mr. Rourke. Just press the button in the dining room."
"Thank you, Mrs. Winant. Good night."
Once she saw him alone, for a moment. It was early morning. She had not slept all night, thinking of him in a room across the hall. She had come out before the house was awake. She walked down the hill, and she found relief in the unnatural stillness of the earth around her, the stillness of full light without sun, of leaves without motion, of a luminous, waiting silence. She heard steps behind her. She stopped. She leaned against a tree trunk. He had a bathing suit thrown over his shoulder. He was going down to swim in the lake. He stopped before her, and they stood still with the rest of the earth looking at each other. He said nothing, turned, and went on. She remained leaning against the tree, and after a while she walked back to the house. Now, sitting by the lake, she heard Winand saying to him, "You look like the laziest creature in the world, Howard."
"I am."
"I've never seen anyone relax like that."
"Try staying awake for 3 nights in succession."
"I told you to get here yesterday."
"Couldn't."
"Are you going to pass out right here?"
"I'd like to. This is wonderful."
He lifted his head, his eyes laughing, as if he had not seen the building on the hill, as if he were not speaking of it.
"This is the way I'd like to die, stretched out on some shore like this. Just close my eyes and never come back."
She thought, "He thinks what I'm thinking. We still have that together. Gail wouldn't understand. Not he and Gail, for this once. He and I." Winand said, "You damn fool. This is not like you, not even as a joke. You're killing yourself over something."
"What?" "Ventilator shafts at the moment. Very stubborn ventilator shafts."
"For whom?"
"Clients. I have all sorts of clients right now."
"Do you have to work nights?"
"Yes, for these particular people. Very special work. Can't even bring it into the office."
"What are you talking about?"
"Nothing. Don't pay any attention. I'm half asleep."
She thought, "This is the tribute to Gail. The confidence of surrender. He relaxes like a cat. And cats don't relax except with people they like." "I'll kick you upstairs after dinner and lock the door," said Winand, "and leave you there to sleep 12 hours.
"All right."
"Want to get up early? Let's go for a swim before sunrise." "Mr. Rourke is tired, Gail," said Dominique, her voice sharp. Rourke raised himself on an elbow to look at her. She saw his eyes, direct, understanding. "You're acquiring the bad habits of all commuters, Gail," she said, "imposing your country hours on guests from the city who are not used to them." She thought, "Let it be mine. That one moment when you were walking to the lake. Don't let Gail take that also, like everything else." "You can't order Mr. Rourke around as if he were an employee of the Banner."
"I don't know anyone on earth I'd rather order around than Mr. Rourke," said Winand gaily. "Whenever I can get away with it."
"You're getting away with it."
"I don't mind taking orders, Mrs. Winand," said Rourke. "Not from a man as capable as Gale."
"Let me win this time," she thought. "Please let me win this time. It means nothing to you. It's senseless, and it means nothing at all. But refuse him. Refuse him for the sake of the memory of a moment's pause that had not belonged to him." "I think you should rest, Mr. Rourke. You should sleep late tomorrow. I'll tell the servants not to disturb you."
"Why, no, thanks. I'll be all right in a few hours, Mrs. Winand. I like to swim before breakfast. Knock at the door when you're ready, Gail, and we'll go down together."
She looked over the spread of lake and hills, with not a sign of men. Not another house anywhere, just water, trees, and sun. A world of their own. And she thought he was right. They belonged together, the three of them. The drawings of Cortland Holmes presented 6 buildings, 15 stories high, each made in the shape of an irregular star with arms extending from a central shaft. The shafts contained elevators, stairways, heating systems, and all the utilities. The apartments radiated from the center in the form of extended triangles. The space between the arms allowed light and air from 3 sides. The ceilings were precast. The inner walls were of plastic tile that required no painting or plastering. All pipes and wires were laid out in metal ducts at the edge of the floors, to be opened and replaced when necessary without costly demolition. The kitchens and bathrooms were prefabricated as complete units. The inner partitions were of light metal that could be folded into the walls to provide one large room, or pulled out to divide it. There were few halls or lobbies to clean, a minimum of cost and labor required for the maintenance of the place. The entire plan was a composition in triangles. The buildings, of poured concrete, were a complex modeling of simple structural features. There was no ornament. None was needed. The shapes had the beauty of sculpture. Ellsworth Toohey did not look at the plans which Keating had spread out on his desk. He stared at the perspective drawing. He stared, his mouth open. Then he threw his head back and howled with laughter.
"Peter," he said, "you're a genius."
He added,
"I think you know exactly what I mean."
Keating looked at him blankly, without curiosity.
"You've succeeded in what I've spent a lifetime trying to achieve, in what centuries of men and bloody battles behind us have tried to achieve. I take my hat off to you, Peter, in awe and admiration."
"Look at the plans," said Keating listlessly. "It will rent for $10 a unit."
"I haven't the slightest doubt that it will. I don't have to look. Oh, yes, Peter, this will go through. Don't worry. This will be accepted. My congratulations, Peter."
"You goddamn fool," said Gail Winand. "What are you up to?"
He threw to Rourke a copy of the banner, folded at an inside page. The page bore a photograph, captioned, "Architect's drawing of Cortland Homes, the $15 million federal housing project to be built in Astoria, Long Island, Keating and Dumont Architects." Rourke glanced at the photograph and asked,
"What do you mean?"
"You know damn well what I mean. Do you think I pick the things in my art gallery by their signatures? If Peter Keating designed this, I'll eat every copy of today's banner."
"Peter Keating designed this, Gale."
"You fool. What are you after?"
"If I don't want to understand what you're talking about, I won't understand it, no matter what you say."
"Oh, you might. If I run a story to the effect that a certain housing project was designed by Howard Rourke, which would make a swell exclusive story and a joke on one Mr. Toohey, who's the boy behind the boys on most of those damn projects.
You publish that, and I'll sue the hell out of you."
"You really would?"
"I would."
"Drop it, Gale. Don't you see I don't want to discuss it?"
Later, Winand showed the picture to Dominique and asked, "Who designed this?" She looked at it. "Of course," was all she answered.
"What kind of changing world, Alva? Changing to what? From what? Who's doing the changing?"
Parts of Alva Skerritt's face looked anxious, but most of it was impatient as he glanced at the proofs of his editorial on Motherhood in a Changing World, which lay on Winand's desk.
"What the hell, Gale?"
he muttered indifferently.
"That's what I want to know. What the hell?"
He picked up the proof and read aloud.
"The world we have known is gone and done for, and it's no use kidding ourselves about it. We cannot go back, we must go forward. The mothers of today must set the example by broadening their own emotional view and raising their selfish love for their own children to a higher plane to include everybody's little children. Mothers must love every kid in their block, in their street, in their city, county, state, nation, and the whole wide, wide world, just exactly as much as their own little Mary or Johnny."
Winand wrinkled his nose fastidiously.
"Alva? It's all right to dish out crap, but this kind of crap?"
Alva Skerritt would not look at him.
"You're out of step with the times, Gale," he said.
His voice was low. It had a tone of warning, as of something baring its teeth, tentatively, just for future reference. This was so odd a behavior for Alva Skerritt that Winand lost all desire to pursue the conversation. He drew a line across the editorial, but the blue pencil stroke seemed tired and ended in a blur. He said,
"Go and bat out something else, Alva."
Skerritt rose, picked up the strip of paper, turned, and left the room without a word. Winand looked after him, puzzled, amused, and slightly sick.
He had known for several years the trend which his paper had embraced gradually, imperceptibly, without any directive from him. He had noticed the cautious slanting of news stories, the half-hints, the vague allusions, the peculiar adjectives peculiarly placed, the stressing of certain themes, the insertion of political conclusions where none was needed. If a story concerned a dispute between employer and employee, the employer was made to appear guilty, simply through wording, no matter what the facts presented. If a sentence referred to the past, it was always "our dark past" or "our dead past." If a statement involved someone's personal motive, it was always "goaded by selfishness" or "egged by greed." A crossword puzzle gave the definition of "obsolescent individuals," and the word came out as "capitalists." Wynant had shrugged about it, contemptuously amused. His staff, he thought, was well-trained. If this was the popular slang of the day, his boys assumed it automatically. It meant nothing at all. He kept it off the editorial page, and the rest did not matter. It was no more than a fashion of the moment, and he had survived many changing fashions. He felt no concern over the "We Don't Read Wynant" campaign. He obtained one of their men's room stickers, pasted it on the windshield of his own Lincoln, added the words, "We don't either," and kept it there long enough to be discovered and snapped by a photographer from a neutral paper. In the course of his career he had been fought, damned, denounced by the greatest publishers of his time, by the shrewdest coalitions of financial power. He could not summon any apprehension over the activities of somebody named Gus Webb. He knew that the banner was losing some of its popularity. A temporary fad, he told Skerritt, shrugging. He would run a limerick contest, or a series of coupons for Victrola Records, see a slight spurt of circulation, and promptly forget the matter. He could not rouse himself to full action. He had never felt a greater desire to work. He entered his office each morning with impatient eagerness. But within an hour he found himself studying the joints of the paneling on the walls and reciting nursery rhymes in his mind. It was not boredom, not the satisfaction of a yawn, but more like the gnawing pull of wishing to yawn and not quite making it. He could not say that he disliked his work. It had merely become distasteful. Not enough to force a decision, not enough to make him clench his fists, just enough to contract his nostrils. He thought dimly that the cause lay in that new trend of the public taste. He saw no reason why he should not follow it and play on it as expertly as he had played on all the other fads. But he could not follow. He felt no moral scruples. It was not a positive stand rationally taken, not defiance in the name of a cause of importance, just a fastidious feeling, something pertaining almost to chastity, the hesitation one feels before putting one's foot down into muck. He thought, "It doesn't matter. It will not last. I'll be back when the wave swings on to another theme. I think I'd just rather sit this one out." He could not say why the encounter with Alva Skerritt gave him a feeling of uneasiness, sharper than usual. He thought it was funny that Alva should have switched to that line of tripe. But there had been something else. There had been a personal quality in Alva's exit, almost a declaration that he saw no necessity to consider the boss's opinion any longer. "I ought to fire Alva," he thought, and then laughed at himself aghast. Fire Alva Skerritt? One might as well think of stopping the earth, or of the unthinkable, of closing the banner. But through the months of that summer and fall, there were days when he loved the banner. Then he sat at his desk, with his hand on the pages spread before him, fresh ink smearing his palm, and he smiled as he saw the name of Howard Rourke in the pages of the banner. The word had come down from his office to every department concerned. Plug Howard Rourke. In the arts section, the real estate section, the editorials, the columns, mentions of Rourke and his buildings began to appear regularly. There were not many occasions when one could give publicity to an architect, and buildings had little news value, but the banner managed to throw Rourke's name at the public under every kind of ingenious pretext. Wynand edited every word of it. The material was startling on the pages of the banner. It was written in good taste. There were no sensational stories, no photographs of Rourke at breakfast, no human interest, no attempt to sell a man, only a considered gracious tribute to the greatness of an artist. He never spoke of it to Rourke, and Rourke never mentioned it. They did not discuss the banner. Coming home to his new house in the evening, Wynand saw the banner on the living room table every night. He had not allowed it in his home since his marriage. He smiled when he saw it for the first time, and said nothing.
Then he spoke of it one evening. He turned the pages until he came to an article on the general theme of summer resorts, most of which was a description of Monadnock Valley. He raised his head to glance at Dominique across the room. She sat on the floor by the fireplace. He said,
"Thank you, dear."
"For what, Gail?"
"For understanding when I would be glad to see the banner in my house."
He walked to her and sat down on the floor beside her. He held her thin shoulders in the curve of his arm. He said,
"Think of all the politicians, movie stars, visiting grand dukes and sash-weight murders whom the banner has trumpeted all these years. Think of my great crusades about streetcar companies, red-light districts, and homegrown vegetables. For once, Dominique, I can say what I believe."
"Yes, Gail."
"All this power I wanted, reached, and never used. Now they'll see what I can do. I'll force them to recognize him as he should be recognized. I'll give him the fame he deserves. Public opinion? Public opinion is what I make it."
"Do you think he wants this?"
"Probably not. I don't care. He needs it, and he's going to get it. I want him to have it. As an architect, he's public property. He can't stop a newspaper from writing about him if he wants to."
"All that copy on him. Do you write it yourself?"
"Most of it."
"Gail, what a great journalist you could have been."
The campaign brought results, of a kind he had not expected. The general public remained blankly indifferent. But in the intellectual circles, in the art world, in the profession, people were laughing at Rourke. Comments were reported to Winand. Rourke, "Oh yes, Winand's pet. The Banner's glamour boy. The genius of the yellow press. The Banner is now selling art. Send two box tops or a reasonable facsimile." "Wouldn't you know it, that's what I've always thought of Rourke, the kind of talent fit for the Winand papers." "We'll see," said Winand contemptuously, and continued his private crusade. He gave Rourke every commission of importance whose owners were open to pressure. Since spring, he had brought to Rourke's office the contracts for a yacht club on the Hudson, an office building, two private residences. "I'll get you more than you can handle," he said. "I'll make you catch up with all the years they've made you waste." Austin Heller said to Rourke one evening, "If I may be so presumptuous, I think you need advice, Howard. Yes, of course, I mean this preposterous business of Mr. Gail Winand. You and he, as inseparable friends, upsets every rational concept I've ever held. After all, there are distinct classes of humanity. No, I'm not talking Toohey's language. But there are certain boundary lines among men which cannot be crossed."
"Yes, there are. But nobody has ever given the proper statement of where they must be drawn."
"Well, the friendship is your own business. But there's one aspect of it that must be stopped. And you're going to listen to me for once."
"I'm listening."
"I think it's fine. All those commissions he's dumping on you. I'm sure he'll be rewarded for that and lifted several rungs in hell where he's certain to go. But he must stop that publicity he's splashing you with in the Banner. You've got to make him stop. Don't you know that the support of the Winand papers is enough to discredit anyone?"
Rourke said nothing.
"It's hurting you professionally, Howard."
"I know it is."
"Are you going to make him stop?"
"No."
"But why in blazes?"
"I said I'd listen, Austin. I didn't say I'd speak about him."
Late one afternoon in the fall, Winand came to Rourke's office, as he often did at the end of the day, and when they walked out together he said,
"It's a nice evening. Let's go for a walk, Howard. There's a piece of property I want you to see."
He led the way to Hell's Kitchen. They walked around a great rectangle, 2 blocks between 9th Avenue and 11th, 5 blocks from north to south. Rourke saw a grimy desolation of tenements, sagging hulks of what had been red brick, crooked doorways, rotting boards, strings of gray underclothing in narrow air shafts, not as a sign of life, but as a malignant growth of decomposition.
"You own that?" Rourke asked.
"All of it."
"Why show it to me? Don't you know that making an architect look at that is worse than showing him a field of unburied corpses?"
Winand pointed to the white-tiled front of a new diner across the street.
"Let's go in there."
They sat by the window at a clean metal table, and Winand ordered coffee. He seemed as graciously at home as in the best restaurants of the city. His elegance had an odd quality here. It did not insult the place, but seemed to transform it, like the presence of a king who never alters his manner, yet makes a palace of any house he enters. He leaned forward with his elbows on the table, watching Rourke through the steam of the coffee, his eyes narrowed, amused. He moved one finger to point across the street.
"That's the first piece of property I ever bought, Howard. It was a long time ago. I haven't touched it since." "What were you saving it for?"
"You." Rourke raised the heavy white mug of coffee to his lips, his eyes holding Wynand's, narrowed and mocking in answer. He knew that Wynand wanted eager questions, and he waited patiently instead.
"You stubborn bastard," Wynand chuckled, surrendering. "All right. Listen. This is where I was born. When I could begin to think of buying real estate, I bought this piece, house by house, block by block. It took a long time. I could have bought better property and made money fast, as I did later. But I waited until I had this, even though I knew I would make no use of it for years. You see, I had decided then that this is where the Wynand building would stand one day."
"All right, keep still all you want.
I've seen what your face looked like just now." "Oh, God, Gale. What's the matter? Want to do it? Want it pretty badly? I think I'd almost give my life for it. Only then I couldn't build it. Is that what you wanted to hear?"
"Something like that. I won't demand your life, but it's nice to shock the breath out of you for once. Thank you for being shocked.
It means you understood what the Wynand building implies. The highest structure in the city, and the greatest." "I know that's what you'd want."
"I won't build it yet, but I've waited for it all these years, and now you'll wait with me. Do you know that I really like to torture you in a way? That I always want to?"
"I know. I brought you here only to tell you that it will be yours when I build it. I have waited because I felt I was not ready for it. Since I met you, I knew I was ready. And I don't mean because you're an architect. But we'll have to wait a little longer. Just another year or two till the country gets back on its feet. This is the wrong time for building. Of course, everybody says that the day of the skyscraper is past, that it's obsolete. I don't give a damn about that. I'll make it pay for itself. The Wynand Enterprises have offices scattered all over town. I want them all in one building. And I hold enough over the heads of enough important people to force them to rent all the rest of the space. Perhaps it will be the last skyscraper built in New York. So much the better. The greatest and the last."
Rourke sat looking across the street at the streaked ruins.
"To be torn down, Howard. All of it. Razed off. The place where I did not run things. To be supplanted by a park and the Wynand building. The best structures of New York are wasted, because they can't be seen, squeezed against one another in blocks. My building will be seen. It will reclaim the whole neighborhood. Let the others follow. Not the right location, they'll say. Who makes right locations? They'll see. This might become the new center of the city, when the city starts living again. I planned it when the banner was nothing but a fourth-rate rag. I haven't miscalculated, have I? I knew what I would become. A monument to my life, Howard. Remember what you said when you came to my office for the first time? A statement of my life. There were things in my past which I have not liked. But all the things of which I was proud will remain. After I am gone, that building will be Gale Wynand. I knew I'd find the right architect when the time came. I didn't know he would be much more than just an architect I hired. I'm glad it happened this way. It's a kind of reward. It's as if I had been forgiven. My last and greatest achievement will also be your greatest. It will be not only my monument, but the best gift I could offer to the man who means most to me on earth. Don't frown, you know that's what you are to me. Look at that horror across the street. I want to sit here and watch you looking at it. That's what we're going to destroy, you and I. That's what it will rise from, the Wynand building by Howard Rourke. I've waited for it from the day I was born. From the day you were born, you've waited for your one great chance. There it is, Howard, across the street. Yours. From me."
Chapter 10. It had stopped raining, but Peter Keating wished it would start again. The pavements glistened. There were dark blotches on the walls of buildings, and since it did not come from the sky, it looked as if the city were bathed in cold sweat. The air was heavy with untimely darkness, disquieting like premature old age, and there were yellow puddles of light in windows. Keating had missed the rain, but he felt wet from his bones out. He had left his office early, and he walked home. The office seemed unreal to him, as it had for a long time. He could find reality only in the evenings, when he slipped furtively up to Rourke's apartment. He did not slip, and it was not furtive, he told himself angrily, and knew that it was, even though he walked through the lobby of the Enright House and rode up in an elevator, like any man on a legitimate errand. It was the vague anxiety, the impulse to glance around at every face, the fear of being recognized. It was a load of anonymous guilt, not toward any person, but the more frightening sense of guilt without a victim. He took from Rourke rough sketches for every detail of Cortland, to have them translated into working drawings by his own staff. He listened to Rourke's instructions. He memorized arguments to offer his employers against every possible objection. He absorbed like a recording machine. Afterward, when he gave explanations to his draftsman, his voice sounded like a disc being played. He did not mind. He questioned nothing. Now he walked slowly through the streets full of rain that would not come. He looked up and saw empty space where the towers of familiar buildings had been. It did not look like fog or clouds, but like a solid spread of gray sky that had worked a gigantic soundless destruction. That sight of buildings vanishing through the sky had always made him uneasy. He walked on, looking down. It was the shoes that he noticed first. He knew that he must have seen the woman's face, that the instinct of self-preservation had jerked his glance away from it, and let his conscious perception begin with the shoes. They were flat, brown Oxfords, offensively competent, too well shined on the muddy pavement, contemptuous of rain and of beauty. His eyes went to the brown skirt, to the tailored jacket, costly and cold like a uniform, to the hand with a hole in the finger of an expensive glove, to the lapel that bore a preposterous ornament. A bow-legged Mexican with red enameled pants, stuck there in a clumsy attempt at pertness. To the thin lips, to the glasses, to the eyes. "Katie," he said. She stood by the window of a bookstore. Her glance hesitated halfway between recognition and a book title she had been examining. Then, with recognition evident in the beginning of a smile, the glance went back to the book title, to finish and make an efficient note of it. Then her eyes returned to Keating. Her smile was pleasant, not as an effort over bitterness, and not as welcome, just pleasant. "Why, Peter Keating," she said. "Hello, Peter." "Katie." He could not extend his hand or move closer to her. "Yes, imagine running into you like this. Why, New York is just like any small town, though I suppose without the better features." There was no strain in her voice. "What are you doing here?"
"I thought... I heard..."
He knew she had a good job in Washington, and had moved there 2 years ago.
"Just a business trip. Have to dash right back tomorrow. Can't say that I mind it either. New York seems so dead, so slow."
"Well, I'm glad you like your job. If you mean... isn't that what you mean?"
"Like my job? What a silly thing to say. Washington is the only grown-up place in the country. I don't see how people can live anywhere else. What have you been doing, Peter? I saw your name in the paper the other day. It was something important."
I'm working."
"You haven't changed much, Katie. Not really, have you? I mean, your face.
You look like you used to, in a way."
"It's the only face I've got. Why do people always have to talk about changes if they haven't seen each other for a year or two? I ran into Grace Parker yesterday, and she had to go into an inventory of my appearance. I could just hear every word before she said it. 'You look so nice, not a day older, really, Catherine. People are provincial.'
But you do look nice. It's nice to see you."
"I'm glad to see you, too. How is the building industry?"
"I don't know. What you read about must have been Cortland. I'm doing Cortland Homes. Housing.
Yes, of course, that was it. I think it's very good for you, Peter. To do a job, not just for private profit and a fat fee, but with a social purpose. I think architects should stop money-grubbing and give a little time to government work and broader objectives.
Why, most of them would grab it if they could get it. It's one of the hardest rackets to break into. It's a closed...
Yes, yes, I know. It's simply impossible to make the layman understand our methods of working, and that's why all we hear are those stupid, boring complaints. You mustn't read the Wynand papers, Peter.
I never read the Wynand papers. What on earth has it got to do with... Oh, I don't know what we're talking about, Katie. He thought that she owed him nothing, or every kind of anger and scorn she could command. And yet there was a human obligation she still had toward him. She owed him an evidence of strain in this meeting. There was none.
We really should have a great deal to talk about, Peter.
The words would have lifted him, had they not been pronounced so easily.
But we can't stand here all day.
She glanced at her wristwatch.
I've got an hour or so. Suppose you take me somewhere for a cup of tea. You could use some hot tea. You look frozen.
That was her first comment on his appearance. That, and a glance without reaction. He thought even Rourke had been shocked, had acknowledged the change. Yes, Katie, that will be wonderful. He wished she had not been the one to suggest it. It was the right thing for them to do. He wished she had not been able to think of the right thing, not so quickly. Let's find a nice, quiet place.
We'll go to Thorpe's. There's one around the corner. They have the nicest watercress sandwiches.
It was she who took his arm to cross the street and dropped it again on the other side. The gesture had been automatic. She had not noticed it. There was a counter of pastry and candy inside the door of Thorpe's. A large bowl of sugar-coated almonds, green and white, glared at Keating. The place smelled of orange icing. The lights were dim, a stuffy orange haze. The odor made the light seem sticky. The tables were too small, set close together. He sat, looking down at a paper lace doily on a black glass tabletop. But when he lifted his eyes to Catherine, he knew that no caution was necessary. She did not react to his scrutiny. Her expression remained the same, whether he studied her face or that of the woman at the next table. She seemed to have no consciousness of her own person. It was her mouth that had changed most, he thought. The lips were drawn in, with only a pale edge of flesh left around the imperious line of their opening. A mouth to issue orders, he thought. But not big orders or cruel orders, just mean little ones, about plumbing and disinfectants. He saw the fine wrinkles at the corners of her eyes, a skin like paper, that had been crumpled and then smoothed out. She was telling him about her work in Washington, and he listened bleakly. He did not hear the words, only the tone of her voice, dry and crackling. A waitress in a starched orchid uniform came to take their orders. Catherine snapped,
"The tea sandwich is special, please."
Keating said, "A cup of coffee." He saw Catherine's eyes on him, and in a sudden panic of embarrassment, feeling he must not confess that he couldn't swallow a bite of food now, feeling that the confession would anger her, he added, "A ham and Swiss on rye, I guess."
"Peter, what ghastly food habits! Wait a minute, waitress. You don't want that, Peter. It's very bad for you. You should have a fresh salad. And coffee is bad at this time of the day. Americans drink too much coffee."
"All right," said Keating.
"Tea and a combination salad, waitress. And, oh, waitress, no bread with the salad. You're gaining weight, Peter. Some diet crackers, please."
Keating waited until the orchid uniform had moved away, and then he said hopefully, "I have changed, haven't I, Katie? I do look pretty awful." Even a disparaging comment would be a personal link.
"What? Oh, I guess so. It isn't healthy. But Americans know nothing whatever about the proper nutritional balance. Of course, men do make too much fuss over mere appearance. They're much vainer than women. It's really women who are taking charge of all productive work now, and women will build a better world."
"How does one build a better world, Katie?"
"Well, if you consider the determining factor, which is, of course, economic..."
"No, I didn't ask it that way." "Katie, I've been very unhappy."
"I'm sorry to hear that. One hears so many people say that nowadays. That's because it's a transition period, and people feel rootless. But you've always had a bright disposition, Peter.
Do you remember what I was like?
Goodness, Peter, you talk as if it had been 65 years ago.
But so many things happened. He took the plunge. He had to take it. The crudest way seemed the easiest. I was married and divorced.
Yes, I read about that. I was glad when you were divorced.
She leaned forward.
If your wife was the kind of woman who could marry Gail Wynand, you were lucky to get rid of her.
The tone of chronic impatience that ran words together had not altered to pronounce this. He had to believe it. This was all the subject meant to her.
Katie, you're very tactful and kind.
But drop the act, he said, knowing in dread that it was not an act.
Drop it. Tell me what you thought of me, then.
Say everything.
I don't mind.
I want to hear it.
Don't you understand? I'll feel better if I hear it. Surely, Peter, you don't want me to start some sort of recriminations. I'd say it was conceited of you.
What did you feel that day when I didn't come, and then you heard I was married? He did not know what instinct drove him, through numbness, to be brutal as the only means left to him.
Katie, you suffered then?
Yes, of course I suffered. All young people do in such situations. It seems foolish afterward. I cried, and I screamed some dreadful things at Uncle Ellsworth, and he had to call a doctor to give me a sedative. And then weeks afterward I fainted on the street one day without any reason, which was really disgraceful. All the conventional things, I suppose. Everybody goes through them, like measles. Why should I have expected to be exempt? As Uncle Ellsworth said.
He thought that he had not known there was something worse than a living memory of pain. A dead one.
And of course we knew it was for the best. I can't imagine myself married to you.
You can't imagine it, Katie?
That is, nor to anyone else. It wouldn't have worked, Peter. I'm temperamentally unsuited to domesticity. It's too selfish and narrow. Of course I understand what you feel just now, and I appreciate it. It's only human that you should feel something like remorse, since you did what is known as jilted me.
He winced.
You see how stupid those things sound. It's natural for you to be a little contrite, a normal reflex. But we must look at it objectively. We're grown-up, rational people. Nothing is too serious. We can't really help what we do. We're conditioned that way. We just charge it off to experience and go on from there.
Katie, you're not talking some fallen girl out of a problem. You're speaking about yourself.
Is there any essential difference? Everybody's problems are the same, just like everybody's emotions.
He saw her nibbling a thin strip of bread with a smear of green, and noticed that his order had been served. He moved his fork about in his salad bowl, and he made himself bite into a gray piece of diet cracker. Then he discovered how strange it was when one lost the knack of eating automatically, and had to do it by full conscious effort. The cracker seemed inexhaustible. He could not finish the process of chewing. He moved his jaws without reducing the amount of gritty pulp in his mouth.
Katie, for 6 years I thought of how I'd ask your forgiveness someday. And now I have the chance. But I won't ask it. It seems beside the point.
I know it's horrible to say that, but that's how it seems to me. It was the worst thing I ever did in my life. But not because I hurt you. I did hurt you, Katie. And maybe more than you know yourself, but that's not my worst guilt.
Katie, I wanted to marry you. It was the only thing I ever really wanted, and that's the sin that can't be forgiven. That I hadn't done what I wanted. It feels so dirty and pointless and monstrous, as one feels about insanity, because there's no sense to it, no dignity, nothing but pain. And wasted pain.
Katie, why do they always teach us that it's easy and evil to do what we want, and that we need discipline to restrain ourselves? It's the hardest thing in the world to do what we want, and it takes the greatest kind of courage. I mean, what we really want. As I wanted to marry you. Not as I want to sleep with some woman or get drunk or get my name in the papers. Those things, they're not even desires. They're things people do to escape from desires. Because it's such a big responsibility, really, to want something.
Peter, what you're saying is very ugly and selfish.
Maybe. I don't know. I've always had to tell you the truth about everything. Even if you didn't ask,
I had to.
Yes, you did. It was a commendable trait. You were a charming boy, Peter.
It was the bowl of sugar-coated almonds on the counter that hurt him, he thought in dull anger. The almonds were green and white. They had no business being green and white at this time of the year. The colors of St. Patrick's Day. Then there was always candy like that in all the store windows. And St. Patrick's Day meant spring. No, better than spring. That moment of wonderful anticipation just before spring is to begin. Katie, I won't say that I'm still in love with you. I don't know whether I am or not. I've never asked myself. It wouldn't matter now. I'm not saying this because I hope for anything or think of trying or... I know only that I loved you, Katie. I loved you, whatever I made of it. Even if this is how I've got to say it for the last time. I loved you, Katie. She looked at him, and she seemed pleased. Not stirred, not happy, not pitying, but pleased in a casual way. He thought, if she were completely the spinster, the frustrated social worker, as people think of those women, the kind who would scorn sex in the haughty conceit of her own virtue, that would still be recognition, if only in hostility. But this amused tolerance, seemed to admit that romance was only human. One had to take it like everybody else. It was a popular weakness of no great consequence. She was gratified, as she would have been gratified by the same words from any other man. It was like that red enameled Mexican on her lapel. A contemptuous concession to people's demand of vanity. Katie, let's say that this doesn't count, this, now. It's past counting anyway, isn't it? This can't touch what it was like, can it, Katie? People always regret that the past is so final, that nothing can change it, but I'm glad it's so. We can't spoil it. We can think of the past, can't we? Why shouldn't we? I mean, as you said, like grown-up people, not fooling ourselves, not trying to hope, but only to look back at it. Do you remember when I came to your house in New York for the first time? You looked so thin and small, and your hair hung every which way. I told you I would never love anyone else. I held you on my lap. You didn't weigh anything at all. And I told you I would never love anyone else. And you said you knew it.
I remember.
When we were together. Katie, I'm ashamed of so many things, but not of one moment when we were together. When I asked you to marry me. No, I never asked you to marry me. I just said we were engaged, and you said yes. It was on a park bench. It was snowing.
Yes.
You had funny woolen gloves, like mittens. I remember. There were drops of water in the fuzz, round, like crystal. They flashed. It was because a car passed by.
Yes, I think it's agreeable to look back occasionally, but one's perspective widens. One grows richer spiritually with the years.
He kept silent for a long time. Then he said, his voice flat, I'm sorry.
Why? You're very sweet, Peter. I've always said men are the sentimentalists.
He thought, it's not an act. One can't put on an act like that. Unless it's an act inside, for oneself.